This is the Alternative Leader Podcast with Mary Williams, inspiring the leaders of today, getting to the grit and discovering the gold with powerful insights and learnings, helping us to lead with strength, determination, and compassion.
Hello, my name is Mary Williams and I'm the Mind Architect, and welcome to the Alternative Leader Podcast. Today's guest is Gareth Squance. Gareth joined the police at 18 and spent 15 years going through some quite interesting events that hopefully we're about to hear. He's been awarded the Freedom of the City of London for duties around drug seizures and gang disruptions, although I was kind of thinking, does anybody want the Freedom of London right now? And you described yourself as a full-time dad and a part-time grass cutter. But there's a sort of a more serious issue under this, is that you ended up leaving really with regard to sort of PTSD. So I'm going to kind of keep the introduction really short and ask you to sort of pick up the story where you'd like to, and let us know sort of what happened within that journey that led you to being a full-time grass cutter.
Okay, so yeah, full-time grass cutter. I love it because it shirks all kinds of responsibility, and I'm honestly quite happy with that. So I joined the police at 18 years old, and I'd applied for the Northern Ireland Police but also the Metropolitan Police at the same time. Mm-hmm. And I was fortunate enough to have the honour really to serve London and serve the people of London, which I embraced and I enjoyed. I was one of these people who got stuck into everything, you know. Nothing gave me fear as a young man, and I just really took any challenge and went for it. And one of those challenges was promotion, so I was really set on furthering my career, and I felt like I had a good leadership quality, and I thought I wanted to share that. I always had people around me who were strong, and I just seemed to bond well with teams. So I thought, right, well, I'll try and do some promotion. So I worked towards promotion. I managed to get some. And shortly after I got promotion, actually, I had an accident. I was volunteered to go out and do a safe cycle week for Boris Johnson, just as he was elected mayor, believe it or not. And during this safe cycle week, I just in this operation, and I was cycling back for breakfast. So we started exceptionally early in the morning. And as I'm cycling back to the police station, a criminal run me over from behind and pretty much left me in the road to die. So I've scooped up by the ambulance, and I remember it very vividly, and it was horrific. I was left with my arm buckled, my hip a bit mangled, and just in the road. And one of the things I remember about that event, actually, and one of the more painful things, is that as I lay there in the road thinking I'm not going to make it, people just filmed me. So instead of helping, they just walked around with their mobile phones filming.
My God.
I never ever seen that footage online, so I don't know what people did with it. I mean, how much fun can that be? But I managed to recover from that, and things are okay. And before my retirement, I'd had another accident, actually, where I chased a suspect, and he had three warrants out for his arrest. Some were quite serious, and I had a really random fall. And as this is the middle of the night, 3 o'clock in the morning, as I've run around the corner, I've slipped on a drain cover. As I've landed, the baton that was attached to my belt went underneath my bulletproof vest and up into my diaphragm.
Oh my gosh.
And it pressed into my heart and lungs, and it caused both my lungs to collapse. And I remember the resuscitation and the chest strains. And actually, I mean, I can recall literally my dying moments very vividly, where I've wanted to speak to my wife again and just see my son's face. He was only 6 months old at the time. And all this stuff added up to massive amount of trauma and sleepless nights and panic, and gosh, it my mental health, I thought it was okay, and I thought, yeah, I'm strong enough to get through this. And over time, it just became really apparent that I was struggling. And I think one of the times where I realized most was I was driving into work one time, and this is after I went through various therapies like counseling and EMDR. I don't know if you're familiar with that therapy. And I heard this siren go the opposite direction. Mm-hmm. So it went northbound. I was going southbound. And I pulled into the hard shoulder on the A1. I literally got out and I was so confused. I had no idea where I was or what was happening. Mm. Just my breathing started to accelerate and this fear. And I literally in that moment just thought, I'm going to drop dead. And I guess that was the first time I really experienced a full-on panic attack. And then from that, health anxiety. Mm. And it was a real interesting journey when looking back on it. And I will by no means claim that I'm through that or I'm over that. But it was certainly something that I had maybe brushed off in the past when I met other people, when they talked about I'm having a panic attack or I'm having, you know, issues with my health. And I would say, oh, pull yourself together. You'll get over it sort of thing. And once it happens in the reality of that, it was phenomenally scary. Mm. And then I retired. So I retired 2012. And I mean, that in itself is a whole another story because that involved huge transition from going from this person who was at work 17, 18 hours a day, sometimes sleeping in my car, so committed to my job. Actually, when Lucy, my wife, was in labor, she went into labor at 3 a.m. and I was due to execute a drugs warrant at 4 a.m. And I said to her, are you okay while I go and execute this drugs warrant? And she went, yeah, I'm okay. So I went to do the drugs warrant, secured the premises, made sure my team was all safe, everything was secure, prisoners were secure. I headed back and then I had to do an LBC interview on the way into the hospital about this drugs warrant. It was with Nick Ferrari and I just remember it so vividly. It was so surreal. I mean, who leaves their wife in labor to go and execute a drugs warrant? So that's where it was. So going from that to being at home full time, with the kids, while my wife she's a director of Alzheimer's Research UK, and she's now well on. She was then too. It was so hard because I had to accept a new role and I had to transition into something that I didn't value. And So from there, things went downhill very quickly for almost 7 years, I would say.
Okay, and. What I'm just sort of I've got so many questions in my head. I'm thinking, where do I start?
I'm so sorry for the information overload. I tried to keep it articulate.
It's brilliant. So I'm going to kind of go back to the beginning. Actually, what led you to go into the police first at 18? What was the inspiration?
I think as a young guy, I was very much, you know, I was brought up in a very troubled area in Northern Ireland. I faced tons of conflict, tons of rats, and nothing really fazed me. So I didn't have any fear. And I thought, you know, I didn't necessarily have the most angelic upbringing, let's say. And I'm not talking about my parents. My parents were fantastic. Mm. But it was more my choices. My choices were awful, quite simply. And the stuff I did, I'm like, what were you? If I could go and speak to my younger self, I'd say, what were you thinking? But I made some awful choices. And it was almost my way of redemption to say, actually, do you know what? I want to help people. And I feel like I've got the strength, capacity. I'm good enough to help people. And that's why I joined the police. It was like, well, take that focus and go and serve a community. And it was like a servant heart almost. Right. It was like, I have to go serve people and help them and deal with crisis and deal with pain. Mm. So yeah, I hope that answers it.
Yeah, that's very interesting answer. It's not the sort of standard, you know, I just wanted to be in the police answer, is it? That you're kind of, you know, 5-year-old gives. I always remember, I don't know if you, you know, obviously I don't know how old your son is now, but when my son, he's now 26, was about 3 or 4 and in nursery, you know, I remember going to pick him up from nursery and they said, oh, we were talking today about what do people want to be when they grow up? And all of, you know, the boys, firemen, policemen, et cetera. And they said, your son said he wanted to be a daddy.
Oh,
I was like,
that is so good.
Oh, so yes, but now he's had 2 younger siblings and he's not the youngest. I'm not sure that would still be
his changed his mind. He's like, no, do you know what? I don't want to see kids
children's
again.
Too many. So going through, I mean, I can't imagine what it would be like to be in a job where I felt physically under threat. So what is that? I'm just pure curiosity. What is that experience like to know that there are people who are actively trying to kill you? I mean, how does that feel?
I think until you really go through physical vulnerability, and I'm talking where you feel that's a reality, it doesn't seem like a reality. So you live this almost superhero complex where you're invincible. And I guess that's maybe the thing that gets overlooked in the police. I think once people do experience trauma where their life is under threat or a colleague's, that's maybe where things change. So it didn't really set in for me until I became physically vulnerable in that I effectively died. So that's the best way I can describe it. I didn't have that. And as a young officer, I think it's important that, I mean, how do you ever express or get somebody to press into their mind or think in that way that you could die? And you know, as a young, if you say that to a young person, they go, yeah, I know. But to feel it and go through it, that's something very, very different.
And so did that awareness, so were you a father at that time?
6 months old, Daniel was. He was my first, so he was our first first child, and that was my little boy.
So how did that affect you as a father to then have that realization that you weren't invincible?
Oh, gosh.
Sorry, hard question.
It's just emotional. I'm thinking about it because I can totally connect with it. It was...
Are you okay to answer it?
Yeah, absolutely. I'll head on through anything, you know. I think for the best part of it, it's about accepting that vulnerability and that maybe eliminating risks. So realizing that you're not invincible is probably not a bad thing. And realizing that you can hurt and you can emotionally hurt. And that's a reality. It's not just something you see where people talk about mental health week or, you know, it's okay to not be okay. These are all real things. And I think that just rang true. So yeah, I remember actually, I just wanted to see their faces again when I lay in the street, taking my last breaths with my lungs collapsed. And it was awful. It was truly awful. And I should be victorious because I'm here and I'm sitting talking to you and my son's 14 and my little girl's 10. But there's something in that that's still massively painful. And even asking that question and thinking about it, for some reason, it still pains me to think. I think it might be, could potentially be joy in there where I'm thinking, actually, do you know what? This is okay. And this is what forms your character or, but yeah, it's, I don't know. I think I've completely dodged that question in a roundabout way, have I?
Well, however you answered it, it's, I think that's fine.
Okay.
So how do you think, I guess what I'm thinking is, so I have a 14-year-old, my youngest is a 14-year-old boy, and I'm thinking, how do you think it changed the way that you parent your son, the experiences that you've gone through? Because there's, I think, you know, we parent our children in different ways. You know, we, as a mother, I parent my son and my daughter, we do it differently. And, I mean, I have 5 children, so, 3 boys and 2 girls. And it's a whole other podcast. and we parent them all differently, don't we? And I just wondered, do you think that experience changed the way that you parented? I mean, it's a hard thing to kind of look back and reflect on, but do you think it did?
I think it's a really good question. And I think there is truth in what you've just said that yes, it did, because I began to prioritize, if you like, what was more important and what wasn't. And I guess this maybe wasn't the thing that I've touched on or discussed before, but for me as a postnatal depression where I just couldn't connect with Daniel as a baby. And we've had these conversations, you know, this isn't something that we don't talk about. This is a reality of life. And since my accident, since going through mental health and the journey that we've been on as a family, we speak very openly about everything. And I mean, everything, and it's painful, but living in truth is so much better than harboring a lie. So I guess we kind of, my perception on being a leader, if you like, became more vulnerable. So I presented this more, and I didn't present it. I presented me as I was, and I almost pulled off my mask.
Yeah.
That took a lot of time and it wasn't something that happened overnight. And looking back now, when you ask the question, I can certainly see the process where that went through, but I can't give you the specifics in terms of how it was a case of you have to be real, you have to speak about how you feel. And I think that what that's led to by having that honest, open relationship from day zero was, well, I look at my boy now and he's supported me through some really tough times. And that includes in our marriage. And he's 14 years old and it's developed a human that's incredibly wise and compassionate and empathetic and understands and doesn't feel like a burden to have these honest conversations. And they would find out eventually anyway, the pains or whatever you're going through. And we speak very honestly about everything and emotions are right up there. So I think if the stuff hadn't happened to me, I don't think I would have been the dad that I am.
I think it's really lovely because I think I see, so a lot of my clients are men in their sort of mid 40s, early 50s. And a lot of them have had that sort of very unemotional upbringing from their own fathers. And actually, you know, even at that age, a lot of the problem is that they're still craving the love and affection of the father, and seeing themselves this kind of tension between, I actually don't know how to vocalize the emotions and sensitivity and, you know, beautiful energy that they have and love and care, but because they haven't learned how to vocalize it, they don't know how to. So then there's that tension between them, which I think in some respects, some of their fathers didn't have because they just were not allowed to feel emotions.
Yeah.
It was that kind of just don't feel it. I think there's a wonderful bit in, I can't remember his name, but he plays Jeremy in, is it Jeremy in Peep Show? Robert Webb. In his book, and he talks about conversation with his stepfather after his mother had died, and he said this, you know, this point that I'm talking, this memory, was where we should have had an honest conversation, and he said, and we couldn't and we didn't, so I just moved out. And he just talks about, you know, this is, we need the whole big, I think, you know, big boys don't cry. We just need that to stop. And actually, you know, when you look at a lot of, you know, look at the huge figures of male suicide, it's that inability, isn't it, to reach out and say, actually, I'm struggling here. And so I'm, you know, like you, I'm very passionate about that. We need to bring our boys, especially, obviously our girls, but our boys especially up to be able to vocalize their emotions and to understand others and to realize that you can be strong and sensitive and emotional. It's all there.
I think that's really interesting. And I know this is your podcast and stuff, but do you mind if I ask you a question just in terms of what you think? So what do you think then in terms of the, say, for example, you have a 14-year-old boy and I'm sure he's on Instagram like mine is, or TikTok or various other things. What do you think then in terms of their access to social media, how do you think that influences their characters or their beliefs or their behaviors?
So it's a really difficult thing. So I would say, if I'm brutally honest, I'm only on social media because it's good for business and it helps me keep in connection with, you know, a few people on Facebook. But mainly I'm not a fan of it. I'm very much an in-person person. And I think that social media, if I'm honest, for children, I have a real love-hate with it because it gives them the connection that we used to have through phone calls and things. Yeah. But to be honest, I'd much prefer them to just be out. And so when I look at my five children, my oldest, I have a 30-year-old, a 28-year-old and a 25-year-old. And then I have a 16-year-old and a 14-year-old. And I can tell you the stark difference of the way that their lives are socially is huge. So my 14 and 16-year-old, you know, I mean, okay, it's COVID, but, you know, they're home every evening. They're not really going out very much. You know, they don't, socializing is all, you know, it's all WhatsApp groups. And I know at this age, I barely saw the older three because they were out. You know, they came out of school, they socialized, they stayed out, they played football, they met up. Yeah. And for me, I have to say, I find that really sad. You know, and I always say to my younger children, you know, in some sense, don't expect me to be around all the time at the moment, but, you know, I work full time, but you're kind of not meant to be here. Yeah. But actually the only socialization that they have out of school now is WhatsApp or games and talking through games. And I genuinely, and my 25-year-old is very anti social media. And he says he feels that we will see a huge difference in the way that people communicate, because of the introduction of phones and social media. And so I'm very anti social media, but it's I do see that for some people who live, you know, they live far away from their friends, or certainly through COVID, I mean, them being able to communicate on WhatsApp and things like that. I didn't have phone, you know, at that age, you know, is huge and has kind of saved them. But yeah, I think it's very exposing. And I think, you know, we often look at girls as being affected by the media and the way they look and the way they dress. Actually, boys are equally, but we don't acknowledge it. I mean, I think, and, you know, I could be corrected, but I think it's actually boys get anorexia more than girls do. And I know that my son, you know, changing, probably hate me saying this, but, you know, the changes he's going through, you know, his self-confidence is dropping. Yeah. So I think social media is very negative, actually, for teenagers. I think they should be out running about, you know, playing football, running about the park, going shopping. You know, I think they need to be together. And I think we've lost the togetherness. But I think, I don't know if I've dodged your question there.
No, you didn't. I think what you're saying ultimately is it comes down to that. And one of the things that I feel as a guy, what we don't have and what we don't do is, we don't invite people into that space where they can hold us accountable. Mm. So for example, if you have somebody and say it's a good friend and they say, well, what have you been looking at on the internet? And you say, well, here it is. You wouldn't do it, you know, it's, or how much have you drank, or, you know, what sort of online chats you have. And these are all things that men feel, well, I'm doing it in private, so it doesn't matter. But actually, doing that stuff in private has a huge impact on your public life and everything you are as a parent or an individual. So what you said, I found very interesting, where you talked about them being together as a group. Well, that starts to form those natural bonds of companionship or friendship. And by socially, the further you are away, I guess, from people, and the physically you are away from people, you don't necessarily build up that trust, maybe.
And I do think there's something about being, and I think, you know, COVID has been a huge issue for this, for all age groups, is humans need to be near other humans. Yeah. You know, we're social creatures. And even the people who say, you know, actually 10 hours of my day I like to be alone, and the 1 hour I want to be with somebody, I think having separated people out, it doesn't help. And I think especially at teenage, is, as you say, it might be just that kind of nudge on the shoulder to your friend walking home, you know, you're right. You know, that's where the communication happens. And it's just that slap on the back at football, you know, it is that kind of, we come together as a team. It concerns me that we lose that. And I definitely think, I remember, I mean, it's a funny, ironic story, really, is that last year I was a keynote speaker for National Men's Mental Health Awareness Day at local business. And putting that talk together, I was sort of saying, well, what am I going to say? Because I can't say I understand, because I can't. and actually, so I talked about role models and I talked about my son, and, you know, my son up to the age of 5, you know, wore beads and he loved pink, and he, you know, I've got a picture of him, you know, the little tiara in his hair, you know, and he was just himself, you know, and then suddenly he went to school and suddenly pink was not cool. And it was not okay to do these things. And if you look at, you know, the Back to the Future films, if you look at them, you know, Marty, the character, is always triggered by the word coward. You know, he's always triggered into stupid action by
was
the word
chicken.
Coward.
I think it was chicken.
Oh, was it chicken? Is it chicken?
I think it was chicken.
Yeah. Okay. Chicken. That's it.
Sorry for interrupting.
No. That's fine. But you know, but that's the thing, isn't it? He doesn't learn. And I think it's only Back to Future 3 where they have him learn not to kind of take the bait. And again, you know, you look at Grease, and actually, you know, Danny loves Sandy, but it takes him ages in front of his friends to admit it. It's the final scene, isn't it? And actually, she's changed for him first. And we went through this, and it was lovely, actually, because I remember somebody who actually became a client afterwards, and he came up to me and said, I must show you a picture of my son. And he showed me this beautiful picture on his mobile of his son dressed in his daughter's uniform for school with his hair up, you know, in a ponytail. And he said, my son wanted to put it on. So I let him, and I was like, I love that you let him do that. So I think it's interesting, because we have all these role models, and I'm thinking kind of back to your career. We have these role models, you know, the Bourne Identity and Mission Impossible, and, you know, these big, strong men who don't really show emotions. And that's the model, you know, that's the model that our boys are growing up with. And what you're saying is, yeah, and that's a great model, but it doesn't actually work. Because if life slaps you in the face, you are actually an incredibly sensitive, emotional man who's then got to deal with that.
Yeah, it's your reset button, isn't it? It's like, yeah. Oh, actually, my identity is wrong. What I thought I was, that's not it. Because why am I feeling the way I'm feeling? Mm. So it challenges everything. Yeah, I know you're absolutely right in terms of your film, the way you describe the films and stuff like that, and how Hollywood would present a male figure, this hero, and yeah, absolutely.
And I was reading a book actually recently by oh my gosh, I can't remember his name now. But it was, he was like an SAS, you know, right into the kind of thick of it soldier. And he talks about starting to recognize that he had PTSD, but not recognizing it was PTSD, but recognizing something was wrong. And he talks about exactly what you said, is he started to recognize that he was frightened and he'd never experienced fear before. And he just said, I just hadn't. And he talks about this one point where he's sitting in this ditch, they're completely surrounded, you know, in the middle of nowhere, the helicopter's coming down to pick him up. And he said, I just stayed in the ditch. I couldn't get out of the ditch and do my job, you know? And he said it was at that point where he just thought, I'm absolutely terrified, that he just was like, okay, something's wrong. And even then when he came back and didn't go out again. But he said it literally took him almost 6 months to a year before I think somebody finally turned around and said, I think you've got PTSD. And even then, you know, it was a huge journey and finding the right therapy and the right counsel, like you say, trying lots of different things. Because I often see people, they try one thing and they go, it didn't work. Or they try one therapist and go, that didn't work. And I'm like, you know, I've been through, I don't know, 15 different therapists in my life. Yeah. And it is, isn't it? It's that readjustment of who am I?
Yeah. Yeah. And I guess also as well, in terms of therapy, it's about timely and it's about what's right in that moment. You know, I think initially when I went through the PTSD stuff and when it started acknowledging that, I don't think counsel and help necessarily because it felt like I was just on repeat and I was talking about the same things, and it's so hard. You almost need somebody that fully grasps it to say, okay, I can see what stage you're at. I think this would be the best option rather than going carte blanche. Well, why don't you do a self-referral? Why don't you have some counseling? Why don't you take some, you know, some of these beta blockers, they'll help. Well, they don't help. All that happens is you suppress it even more.
So where are you now in that journey? And how did you start to come out of it? What was the kind of turning point for you?
In terms of PTSD and depression, I think depression really a bit of a breakthrough last year. There was some real more personal stuff went on. And I mean, you're talking like 7 years of absolute hell. And I mean, literally suicide, you know, I won't steer away from that. It was points where I felt like this is it. I'm going to take my own life. I don't want to be here. I don't have a purpose. I have no value. And all these lies that became really relevant. And I kept pushing through that. And I started photography. And I'd done photography since 2006 anyway, but I started photographing this tree, one tree every day. And it was on my walk where I'd walk with my little dog, who sadly, he died last week, actually. He's only 8 and a half. But I would photograph this tree, and I'd photograph this tree against the backdrop of the countryside. So the countryside obviously has so many changeable weather patterns and clouds and various stuff going on. And I knew and noticed that tree was always consistent and it just grew. And it didn't matter what was going on around it, how strong the wind was or how strong nature was pulling around it. It stood firm and it stood tall, and this tree became a bit of a symbol. So I started to share this on social media, and then other people joined the journey of the tree. And that kind of being able to share those feelings and speak honestly and openly about grief and to actually understand an emotion. So I did my own studying into emotional health and what emotions are and why we feel them, and do they define us? Well, no, they don't. Of course they don't. And going through that process, but then articulating that and being able to share it with other people, and then seeing other people come on board and go, wow, this means a lot. I mean, it got to the point where ITV had picked it up and they started using some stuff as well. And it was phenomenal to see this. So I guess the encouragement that, oh gosh, you're actually doing something right. You know, by sharing your story, you're helping other people. So I guess that was the turning point for me in terms of the feeling really low. But depression, I guess, isn't just about feeling low. It's about I can't even nail what it feels like, but it's like, I just don't want to do it. I can't be bothered. Or, and this is where I mentioned earlier about having people that hold you to account are important, because you need people to look in from the outside and speak into that and say, well, what's going on? What are you doing? You know, where is it? let's look at where the pain is and let's go with that. And more often than not, there's a trigger or there's something else. But in terms of the nightmares and various things, they still come. And I think PTSD is one of those things that you just have to live with and accept. It's part of you. But I guess optimistically, what it does is it refines your character, in my opinion, dare I say this, for the better, where you can understand. So you can look at somebody and you can in the street and you can see depression. You look at somebody in the street, you can see loneliness. And I mean, that's a real gift, I think. And actually emotionally connecting with somebody else is something that I didn't have the capacity or emotional intelligence to do as a young man. So that did not answer your question either.
We're doing so well, aren't we?
I feel like I'm just waffling and not answering questions.
I think, you know, it's a really interesting, I was reflecting when you were talking. So I've just finished writing a book, and it's a deeply therapeutic book around basically how if you sort yourself out as a human being, that you lead better. I mean, that's what it's about. So it's kind of saying, let's stop trying to kind of give leaders, you know, top tips. Let's actually help them be happier humans who've cleared all their emotional baggage. And then we can give them some tips too. But you have to do the internal work first. And in the introduction, I put in a piece about suicide, you know, that you know, actually, you know, how women tend to feel and how men tend to feel, and that it can lead to suicide. And the publishers and I had this kind of conversation about what that was just too hard. That was too hard hitting to be in the introduction, and it ended up being kind of removed and kind of scaled down, you know, a bit. And they were saying, oh, you need to get people into the book. And I really struggled with it, because part of me just thought, this just needs to be said.
Yeah.
You know, it just needs to be said, actually. And, you know, I have a lovely plumber who comes in and looks after me. And that sounds terrible, doesn't it?
That sounded so Emmanuel.
So terrible.
What kind of podcast is this?
I know. And the beauty of it is I'm not going to edit that out. Because that's just real. I have a plumber who comes and looks after my plumbing. I'm just going to say it. Okay. And, happily married plumber. But anyway, he and I were having this conversation, and he was saying 5 of his friends had committed suicide. And he said not one of them said anything. And he is, you know, a lovely guy. You could talk to him about anything. My mother died at Christmas, you know, he gave me a hug, you know. He's not somebody you couldn't talk to. And actually 5 of his friends have done that. And you just think, it's so sad that we are still in this, you know, big boys don't cry. You know, my son, you know, my daughter, she cries, she'll come and have a cuddle. My son, you know, it's a harder thing, and he has to, I've taught him to write it down, and it makes me so sad that we're encouraging people into jobs like the job that you were in, which is just going to be tough. It's going to be tough and it's going to be hard, and great, go and do that job and enjoy that job. But actually we need to be there for people when it's then tough. The same with postnatal depression and things like that. And you talked about that from a male point of view. We shy away from pain, and we do that naturally as humans, but we do that socially as well. And I remember I had a miscarriage 16 years ago, and, you know, no one had talked about it. So I just felt defective when I started to talk about it, and people started to say, yeah, we've had one too, or we've had two, you know, I kind of was like, oh, okay, I'm not alone. And I think that aloneness is often what leads us, you know, to that more serious depression, and to not be able to say, it's not just me.
I think actually you're really onto something there as well, in terms of when you talked about almost harboring that feeling. So harboring that thought that I am defective. Well, that's an outright lie, first of all. But by not speaking that out and declaring, well, this is how I feel, it just manifests. So I really connected with what you said there in terms of holding on to those negative lies or emotions. And this is where, again, I keep, I've said it a few times now, is by having people around you where you can speak that stuff out, and but not everybody has the capacity, or not everybody understands the importance. And as you said at the start, we are social people. We need contact. But having those people there to say that to, if you had said that to somebody at the start of your journey, this is how I feel, I feel effective, they would have said, well, I've had two, or I've had five, you know, you're like, oh, wow, okay, I don't feel useless, you know?
Yeah. And I think it's, you know, on a kind of light note, you know, I'm just kind of going into menopause. I've got terrible brain fog. I can't remember anything, you know, and you know, there's part of me that sits thinking I've got early stage dementia, you know, and my mother and both grandparents died of it. And it, you know, it's a real fear. And then I go and I talk to other women and they go, oh God, I can't remember anything either, you know, and it makes you feel better. You know, and I know men who've given me the kind of, you know, their side of kind of getting older. And I think it is, it's basically saying, you know what, we're all human.
Yeah,
we're all human and we're all vulnerable. And I actually, you know, I often say, because I have a you know, a lot of male clients, and the, you know, the thing they struggle with, really, really struggle with, is being vulnerable, you know, with me and with others. And actually, I always say to them, you know, you come in here and you cry, you come in here and you tell me that life's hard. Actually, my admiration for you, just, it just goes through the roof, because you're saying, this is who I am. This is how I am. This is what I feel. And I say to them, you know, we kind of almost slogan it, you know, there's strength and vulnerability, but there really is strength and vulnerability.
Absolutely.
It just really is. And actually, it's the people who won't say, I'm having a hard time, or this is difficult, or whatever. You know, they're the people who are not strong. And I think I really hope that generationally we can kind of turn that around and spin it so that, you know, boys especially learn that. You know, actually, you know, it's, I remember saying to a male client of mine once, you know, you don't have to be the big man that provides everything. And he said, well, my wife has literally said that to me. And I was like, okay, we've got a lot of work on society to do then, you know, cultures and things like that. But
expectations, identity.
Absolutely. So moving on, how do you like being full-time dad now?
So now it's, it brings, I guess, as the kids get older, it brings this a very different challenge where attitudes change, you know, social media and the discussions around pornography, especially when you've got young male in the house, you know, with females, very different. We don't give her as much access to internet content. We, as I said earlier, we just lost my little Cocker Spaniel. He was 8 and a half. He was like my PTSD dog. So I got him as my PTSD leaving from the police dog. Right. And he had some magic mushrooms in the garden and basically died this horrific death last Wednesday. And then I've literally just been to the vet, and my daughter's dog, who's 3 months old, has got a collapsed trachea. So it's a disease and it's not going to live massively long. So I'm like, okay, yeah, so being a dad brings up all these different challenges and these big conversations, you know, the conversations that we have when I pick them up from school, you know, how was your day? Who said what? And it's not just I like to keep it very focused, the questions as well. So I'll ask them, if they say, yeah, it's all right, we'll ask them a more specific question. Well, tell me what the best thing that happened today was. Or, and we start getting into emotional conversations and bigger conversations, especially over dinner. You know, I'm fortunate enough where I get to spend dinner and breakfast with them and just engage with them and think, I think about inheritance. So, and that sounds a bit odd, but I think about, well, what is my inheritance to them? And it's to try and share the best qualities that I have with them. It's not about the money. It's not about the house. It's about actually making them a better version of me or giving them the opportunity, not making them, because that sounds really communist, but like giving them the opportunity to become a better version than I am in terms of emotions and, but it's different than being the police for sure. And when I said in jest about, you know, being the grass cutter, that's so true. I mean, we're fortunate up here. We've got 5 acres of land. So I literally cut the grass all the time. And I tell you what, there's nothing wrong with cutting the grass and having a beer.
It's funny, you're making me smile. So I'm not a huge pet person, but I've always loved cats, so I'm very much a cat person. Not that we can't have them, because my daughter's allergic, but my eldest daughter, who's 30, she has bipolar, and so she was diagnosed when she was early 20s, you know, suicide attempts. I mean, she's very open with it, so she won't mind me sharing it. And she got a hamster, Charlie, and Charlie lived with her, and he was kind of her little companion all the way through her journey through, you know, getting to grips with the bipolar and becoming well again. And a few years ago, Charlie died, and he died in my care.
Oh, no.
So I'd been given him to look after because she'd moved house and couldn't take him with her. And we had him for, I think, about 3 or 6 months. And I was the one that took him to the vets, you know, this little hamster that I've had nothing to do with. And they said, you know, I'm really sorry, actually, he's got cancer and it's probably best, you know, to put him to sleep. And I sobbed and sobbed in the waiting room. And even in my own head, I'm thinking, this is crazy. You don't even like the hamster. It's just the hamster. And then I found myself saying, but he's the bipolar hamster, you know, he's the hamster who got her through it. And, you know, so and you could see these people and they just didn't get it, because actually it was, like you say, it was so significant of the journey that I'd watched her get through to. Yeah. I mean, she's so healthy now. She's amazing. And so that really resonated with me. And also when you say about a better version, I always say to my kids, you know, I didn't have a great childhood and you know, that damage has come down. That's why I do the job that I do. And I always say to my kids, do you know what? Look at me, look at your dad, take the best bits and move on. And my daughter was 30 in May. And I said to her, you know, you are the woman that I look up to. And I want to try and be more like you, because I think, you know, you are a better version of me.
That's beautiful.
So I totally resonate when you say that's, you know, that's what you want, isn't it? You want them to kind of, you know, take the best bits and move on.
I think as well, what's important within that, you have to create that space for it to happen. It's not just gonna happen. They're just gonna say, oh, you have to be in that. And rightly, as you've said, identify that place where you can have the freedom to express those and have those conversations and unravel life together and be aware that, you know what, we all make massive mistakes, but it's about having that, you know, I guess here in this house, we try and have this safety in truth. So when you speak truth, you're not judged for it. And it's like, okay, well, how are we going to get through that? As team squads, how are we going to deal with that? it's sometimes easier said than done, but I think we've done okay and we learn. We're all learning. There's no perfection in this, but it's having that freedom to not be frightened to tell the truth.
Yeah. I think that's absolutely beautiful. I think I could talk to you all day, and I've taken a lot of your time, so I'm going to end it there. But before we go, there's three questions that I probably didn't prep you about, but that I ask every guest, so I'm going ask you.
Okay.
So the first one is, and it seems a trivial question, but actually it often has great significance. When you look back through the challenges that you went through and how you came out of that, were there any books or films or pieces of music that really resonated for you at the time? Was there anything that almost you see as part of that journey?
Oh, that is good. That is a good question. I think for me, it was most of Hans Zimmer's scores. So I honestly, music really moved me and it enabled me to connect to the material that I make, or via, you know, be it media or video or pictures, any, it was always about the music first. So it was music and then emotion and then listening to that and pushing through it. So yeah, actually I went to see Hans Zimmer and it was incredible. Watched them live at Wembley when we were allowed to socialize. So yeah.
Those times.
Oh gosh.
Okay. All right. My second question is, people that are listening to you today, whatever they're going through, people who are going through a challenge and just feeling a bit lost, can't see the light at the end of the tunnel, what would be your takeaway, either kind of, I call it thought action or an action that they can do literally right now, something they can think or do?
Okay. So one of the things that I really like to encourage people when I talk to them is, first of all, say that you're strong enough, that you're good enough and you're worthy. So anybody that tells you any different is talking absolute nonsense. I think it's, my action would be sit down at the end of your bed and ask, start with you. It's not external. It starts with you. And then find somebody to speak to about it and somebody that won't judge you or say, what you do that for? Or, you know, literally just as a friend, if you're listening to this and you've got somebody going through that, just sit there and go, I'm here and we're in this together and we're walking together. So yeah, I guess that you're good enough, you're strong enough and you're worthy, and speaking truth.
That's really lovely. Okay. And the third question, and it doesn't have to be related to anything that we've talked about, but if you were standing in front of the world leaders combined right now, what would you say to them?
Be honest. Be honest, because there's so much mess, and forget about you. Just be honest, you know, drop that selfishness and that want for your own gain, you know, try and give rather than take. And that would change the world, I think.
Yeah, absolutely. Gareth, thanks so much. It's been really lovely, and you know, definitely left me thinking about things.
I hope you enjoy. And honestly, I've loved talking to you. I loved your perspective, and especially around the social media stuff. And thank you so much for having me.
No, thank you for coming on. Thank you very much.
Hi, I'm Mary Williams, as you know, and thank you so much for listening to the Alternative Leader podcast. I search for guests to bring you lessons and learnings that can help move you forward in your life, help you achieve the success that you want to, in whatever way that shows up for you, to help you lead powerfully, whether that's in your own life, as your parenting, your personal, or your professional, and make you the best that you can be. If you've enjoyed the show, please rate and review it, and please share it with as many people as you think also want to move forward and gain success in their lives. If you want to find out more about me, go over to my website, which is www.mary-williams.com. That's www.mary, which is mari-williams.com, and you'll find links to all of my social media profiles there. There's also a Facebook community that you can join. And again, all the links will be on the website too. I hope you have an absolutely fantastic day. And thank you so much for listening.